It's hard to predict how the current pandemic will affect the work of artists in television and film and theater, but that doesn't mean we can't try. What will change? What won't change? How might creators react?
Today, we are stepping back to make some guesses about the future of pop culture and think about what's to come. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. And today, we're making some pop culture pandemic predictions on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. So don't go away.
On Facebook, there are these three brothers who love guns, say guns are overregulated, say the NRA is too quick to compromise.
And they're gaining more followers every day.
They're very in-your-face and offensive, and by God, I love them for it.
Listen now to the No Compromise podcast from NPR.
Welcome back. You just met NPR Music's Stephen Thompson. Also with us from his home studio is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And also with us is our own Aisha Harris. Hi, Aisha.
Hi, Linda.
So this is the first time that the four of us have all been together since Aisha came on as our fourth permanent host. We are so delighted to have her with us. Woohoo! Yay! Woo-hoo! And we're also delighted to say that this episode was her idea. So we are already harvesting wonderful thoughts from her wonderful brain. So what we're going to do is we're going to go around the table and we're going to talk a little bit about these predictions. Stephen, why don't you kick us off?
Well, I decided to try to go with something vaguely optimistic, which is, I don't know if that means it's going to come true, but I was thinking a lot about live theater and what becomes of live theater in a world where it's really not safe for a bunch of people to gather, especially to gather around places where people are singing. And I've been thinking a lot about live theater and kind of how it relates to sports, where like the NBA is playing the NBA playoffs in a bubble where you put all of the NBA players in a contained space where COVID cannot get in. And I think the way to save live theater, which is really struggling right now because there's no way to safely perform it, I'm imagining a future where Broadway productions are taking place within bubbles, without crowds, with a robust pay-per-view model. Live theater has done some experimenting with pay-per-view. Obviously, you have a recording of Hamilton has been put out during the pandemic. But I'm imagining a future where Broadway starts to take place without a crowd, with a pay-per-view model, can be beamed into people's houses in a way that I think can persist beyond the pandemic and kind of create a funding model that's going to be hard to pass up even after crowds return. And I think you're going to see a blurring of those lines with live theater in ways that are likely to frustrate purists who really believe that live theater should only happen in a room with a crowd, you know, in this kind of ephemeral way. I think you're going to see theater's cultural footprint really expand in ways that, you know, people who can't necessarily get out to a Broadway production are going to be able to experience live theater from their homes in ways that I think are really going to change theater forever.
That is so interesting. And I will say, if this is a topic that you're interested in, the New York Times did a piece where they talked to, I think, 20 theater people from various parts of theater about kind of how to revitalize theater, not only because of the pandemic, but, you know, in general to broaden the audience. And I believe embracing streaming is one of the things that they talked about. So I think there's a possibility that you're going to turn out to be right there, buddy.
That would be unusual.
Yeah, we don't have a good track record when it comes to predictions.
No.
So
we don't.
No, if you want your predictions bold and wrong, this is the place to go.
So my prediction comes from the world of television. You can see networks and production companies starting to try to figure out what to film while people are still quarantined. There is a film on HBO called Coastal Elites that is a series of monologues that were all taped during quarantine. There has been already a show called Love in the Time of Corona. They're trying to figure out what you can film and when. And I think that, you know, there may be bubbles and things like that, but I think they're eventually going to come up with a way to cheaply create something that will be really successful, that will be created out of like Zoom meetings or something like, you know, fictional, obviously, Zoom meetings or online dating or whatever. Somebody's going to crack that. Nobody's cracked that yet, but I think somebody's going to crack that. And I think it's going to be Netflix, and I'll tell you why. Volume. Netflix just makes so much stuff right now. They are throwing money at all kinds of different things. They want a piece of absolutely everything that anybody is doing. So I think it's going to be Netflix just because so much is Netflix. So I am looking for a quarantine formatted Netflix success story. That is my quarantine. That's my pandemic prediction.
My prediction, I think, kind of answers that and probably disagrees with that, because on paper, the times that we're living through, if you want to call it living, should be made for the Glens among us. I mean, think about it. No parties.
Yep.
No hugging. No sports, right? This is the age of the indoor kid. And yet, I hate it. I hate everything about it. I'm bored by quarantine. I want it to be over. And if you look back, after 9/11, it took roughly 4 or 5 years for that event to get kind of taken up and processed by writers on books, movies, television. And what I mean by that is really starting to grapple with it and really engage with it. And because the cultural churn is so much faster now, we burn through things faster, we consume it like fuel, logic would dictate that that turnaround time would be much shorter, like maybe a year or two. But my prediction is that the exact opposite will happen. My prediction is it's going to take much longer, longer even than 5 years, for fiction to really start engaging with this time. And I know you see it here and there. You talked about a couple examples, Linda, but I think it's not going to have that same effect, because this, what we're going through now, is very different from 9/11. 9/11 was a single shocking event followed by a lingering trauma. And that is a very familiar dynamic. It's a thing that happens. You know, a thing happens and there are ripples. This thing we're going through now is all ripples, all trauma, all the time. And it is also at the same time comparatively diffuse. You know, it doesn't have a single universally recognized trigger agent, right? Of course, 9/11 was followed by the Iraq War, which kept the whole thing alive in public consciousness. And there was a very similar, if you remember, a very similar sense of helpless dread in the beginning, very similar to the one we're living in now. But something happened. We got sold a narrative, a revenge narrative, a justice narrative, if you want to be more charitable. You know, a bad thing happened to us, so we're going to take it out on those who did it. Now, that was the story we were told. Obviously, the truth was different, but it was a familiar story, a comforting story, and it conformed to all the recognized parameters that we've ingested in Western culture. And the movies, television shows, books, and plays that emerged just kind of reinforced that good versus evil notion, which helped us to process it, if not really understand it. And this thing we're going through now does not conform to any established narrative. It's not a revenge narrative, a justice narrative, a good versus evil narrative. And you can try to slot it into one, but it's going to be a rougher fit. So I think that once this thing is over, because we can't crystallize a kind of narrative framework around it, we're not going to want to look back on this right away. We're not going to want to trade stories about where we were and how we coped, because we all know. And we're going to want to get some daylight between us and it. We're going to need more time to pass. The way we're living it is, it's going on for so long, and it's so unavoidable, and it's so unrelenting. And even if you don't buy all my pretentious crap about narrative structure, on a basic level, I can't foresee there being an appetite for it. I mean, I can't imagine a wave of anything like nostalgia for this very crappy time. And, you know, every time I read that a showrunner is like, says like, well, we had a whole season planned out, but then this happened and we had to scrap the whole thing so we could write about, you know, and make it all about Zoom calls. And like, I just, bad choice. Because I say, once we're out of this, we are going to need to be out of this for a good long time.
That is really smart.
I think it's hard to tell a crisis story that is so inextricably tied to boredom.
Yeah. That's it.
That's really hard to sell people.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you, Glenn, and I think my prediction in some ways is a nice jumping off point from there, because, you know, when I think about how we are going to process this, I'm looking towards 10 years from now. We are not going to be out of this anytime soon. It'll probably be at least another year or two before we can actually go to movie theaters. Our lives as we knew them before are not going to be quote unquote normal anytime soon. And so because of that, my prediction is more so about the visual cues and the visual language we're going to see specifically in film and TV. When you think about a movie set during the Great Depression. It's not necessarily about the Great Depression, but there's a certain language that you can understand that goes beyond just like costumes and whatnot. There's, a freight train, someone hopping a freight train. You have the migrant worker, the signs that say like the bank has now taken over this abandoned property. I think of that scene from Bonnie and Clyde where the farmer is encouraged by Bonnie and Clyde to like shoot up his abandoned farm that has been taken over by the bank. And that's like a very symbolic moment. And while Bonnie and Clyde is not necessarily about the Great Depression, it's there, it's underneath. And I think like Glenn was saying, it's going to be a very much, we're not going to want to look back on it directly, but it'll be an undercurrent. And mm-hmm. I think some of the visual clues will kind of look like, you can sense that it's probably 2020 or 2021 if all of a sudden there's a close-up on a mask, like a used mask lying on the ground, like a character steps over it. Or, you know, there's a comedic scene or something, or there's a moment happening in one scene where a character like takes a moment to walk away, stick their head out the window, and then join the applause that's happening outside, and then just goes back to whatever they're doing. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be very like subtle moments and cues in the same way we've seen with other turning points in history that have affected the way we watch movies and TV. You know, 9/11 is another great example where even though it took a few years after that for filmmakers to really wrestle with it, it's still everywhere, and especially in our action movies, the way in which movies like Batman versus Superman, the Dark Knight trilogy, really reference visually the ways in which we process that. Like just action scenes where you see buildings crumbling and dust and all these things that evoke this feeling. And even though it's not about that, as an audience member, you still think about that. And so there's going to be a huge undercurrent 10 years from now, 15 years from now, and there will be ways in which you can know right away, oh, this is set in 2020. Oh, this is set in 2021.
Yeah.
Like, basically, you're saying that a mask is going to be the equivalent of, like, All Star by Smash Mouth, where you know that if you hear All Star by Smash Mouth, you can carbon date something to, like, was it 1998 to 2001, something like that?
Although Smash Mouth, still, that song is still in so many movies. So how do we know?
But I think it's in movies that I'm referencing 20 years ago.
True. Yeah. Yes.
Right. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe great art will come out of this, about this. I mean, I'm working on something now. It's a one-man show called Mom, You're Muted. Mom, You're on Mute. You're Muted.
That's the full title.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, I think that if there's one thing we can say for sure, it's that we are just guessing. So we would love to hear your pandemic predictions. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Click the microphone, Mom. Click the microphone. Can you see the little microphone?
Thank you, Linda.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, subscribe